Okay, while I wait for the camera assistance, I think we should already start. Welcome to the September session of the IESB. For the first time in, I think, over a year, we are complete, thanks to the fact that we have three new board members, Nick Anderson from the UK, and Tarka from West Australia, and Jian Chao Lu from China. Welcome, and we look forward to your contribution to our meetings. We are going to start today with a discussion on dynamic risk management and educational session, and I give the floor to Russ.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. I would like to begin just by commenting that this material I'll split into two sections. The split should be relatively obvious, but the first part will be a discussion on prepayment risk, very much just on what it is, what problems it causes, the various approaches to managing those problems, and also their various shortcomings. Once we've completed that material, we'll change topics to something relatively unrelated to start discussing capacity, exactly what that means. I'll build up that story around capacity through conversation on margin management and discuss how that impacts both banking and non-banking sectors. The idea here is to really begin the conversation of the current reporting framework around dynamic risk management. But to understand the current reporting framework, capacity is a key aspect of that. As per usual, please feel free to stop me as you have questions, and I will do my best to respond. I apologize in advance if I will defer your question to later in the material as it is answered, perhaps on a different slide. But so I'll begin on slide 6, if that makes sense. So to date, in all our conversations around dynamic risk management, I've assumed that the asset profile, the assets in that profile, will mature at their contractual maturity date. They will last until the contract says it lasts. That makes managing repricing assets relatively straightforward. Unfortunately, this assumption does not hold true for at least a portion of assets. Certain customers have the contractual right to prepay or liquidate their loan earlier than the contractual maturity date. Perhaps oversimplifying the problem this causes is that if an asset can reprice pretty much at any time, then if I assume it's going to last to its contractual maturity date, that may not occur, and therefore NIM can, or the asset can reprice earlier than expected, and therefore NIM can reprice earlier than expected. My objective is to kind of understand how NIM will reprice and manage that accordingly. This obviously causes a problem. On slide 6 and 7, I provide a very quick walkthrough of this problem pictorially. In the normal format I've done this in, you can see I've got some fixed loans for 5 years, and funded by some debt for 5 years. I have a spread between revenue and cost of funding of 100 basis points, and so NIM looks like it's fixed for 5 years. Therefore, I've got stable NIM for the period of this example. This sounds like a good story. However, if I switch to slide 7, hypothetically, shortly after origination, for any reason, I've made one up that the market rates are now lower, the borrower exercises their right to prepay or liquidate, and therefore the borrower changes their original loan for a new loan, what is generally called a refinancing. But the rate on that loan has now changed from 6.5 to 4.5 in this theoretical example. So while the profile here still looks fixed, I've got fixed cash inflows, I've got fixed cash outflows for 5 years, the NIM has repriced unexpectedly. And so while I kind of had expectation of 100 basis points at the beginning, it's now negative 100 basis points. So the comment here is that prepayment risk will result in repricing potentially earlier than expected.
Yeah, Mary?
Ross, just something I want to put down as a marker to, we've got to remember to come back to it. I think it's not so relevant to today's discussion. Seven, you're starting from the premise that the cost of deposits, the cost of deposits is zero, that's fine, and that the deposit base never matures. And the more I thought about that, the more I had some question about that, because I think the individual components of the deposit base may mature. I mean, I have a bank account. I'm not going to live forever. And so at some point, you know, that's going to terminate my deposit account. I understand that we're looking at this in the context of a portfolio of deposits. And I don't want to bring that complication into this discussion, but I just want to put down the marker that the assertion of fact that there's deposits that never mature, that's only true when you look at it on a some maturing being replaced basis.
Noted.
So you're sort of ignoring the prepayment risk on the deposit side for the purposes of this discussion, aren't you?
Yep. slide 8 actually kind of talks about that a little bit, but slide 6 and 7, the example focuses on, well, if I have a debt-funded portfolio, the problem is perhaps a little bit obvious to understand. This is no different if it was a deposit-funded portfolio there. We talked about having an asset profile and having that target repricing desired by management. It's no different if it's debt-funded or deposit-funded here. If the asset can behave unexpectedly, then that's going to cause a challenge in trying to align the profile between the assets and what I would like it to be. So the simple conclusion of this introductory section is that if DRM is trying to consider NIM and how NIM will reprice, it must consider prepayment risk as it does that. Very good. Please turn to slide 10. Before I discuss the more complicated methods of managing this problem, the simplest way to deal with it doesn't involve derivatives at all. If a borrower has the right to effectively repay or put their loan back to the bank, the simplest way for this to be managed is to allow the bank the right to put the funding back to the investor. So from that perspective, using callable debt is a very effective way of managing this problem. Slides 10 and 11 walk through a basic example here, and I'll highlight a couple points. Again, I've got my loan for 5 years. The debt's around for 5 years as well. I'm highlighting the debt is more expensive than it was previously. It's 6%, not 5.5%. If an investor, if they purchase callable debt, they understand it's callable, and therefore they will demand compensation for that. And therefore, callable debt is more expensive than normal debt. So that's the how you would begin is you would issue the loan, you would issue the callable debt first, then you'd issue the loan. Step 2 on slide 11, you can see that the customer might exercise their right to liquidate at some point, so the loan will disappear. I'll be left with the debt. It's a very profitable place to be. I will call the debt, and then the profile will effectively reset. Step 3 shows there's nothing there. I would then restart the cycle. I would issue new debt, and I would fund new loans, and I would reestablish the NIM that I previously had. It's a relatively simple way to manage it.
Russ, if I may interrupt, wouldn't normal business practice be that the bank, in the contract with the customer who borrows the money, would have like a penalty in case of repayment? Wouldn't that be the usual way to deal with this risk?
Absolutely. So the easiest way to deal with prepayment risk is to not allow it, or to have provide a...
Allow it, but have a... compensation in place.
Yes, it's very common to charge, I'm going to use my words very carefully here, to charge reasonable compensation. but it is very common for that form of interest rate differential parity to penalty to be there to allow the organization to effectively break their funding.
Yeah.
So that's very common. This material doesn't really discuss prepayment penalties too much. It mostly focuses on where there is no prepayment penalty. Those loans do exist. There are loans that out there, the term in the business is called fully open. But perhaps it's fair to say that the best and the most common way of addressing prepayment risk is to have a barrier to allow customers to do it, either through penalty or just simply not allowing it. Yeah. So.
But Ross, I think why you're giving us these examples is that those two things you just said don't cover all the cases.
Correct.
So there are other cases outside those two examples, and that's why we have to go through this.
Correct. So on slide 12, if we're in a world where there are no penalties, then callable debt is a pretty easy way to manage the problem. But why doesn't everybody just issue lots of callable debt then? There are practical problems here, is that there is limited market depth for callable debt. Investors don't like it because it can be called. people do not like having to manage option risk. And so if I'm an investor, why would I choose to participate in that? There are some reasons why you would, but it's limited. The second point here, called requirement for frequent issuance. So the bank is issuing new loans daily. Not every single loan will have this prepayment problem, but a lot of them could. And so if I want to match funding and loans perfectly, I'm going to have to be issuing a lot of callable debt, and I'm going to have to be doing that frequently. Frequent issuances of debt on large scale for the capital markets is difficult and certainly does not happen daily for an institution. So it's not realistic to expect the organization to issue debt kind of every day. And thirdly is kind of this notional problem that individual loans can be very large. They can be a million currency units. But debt issued into the capital markets is usually in the hundreds of millions, currency units or billions potentially. And so it would be very strange to partially call a debt instrument. I'm not even sure if that's possible. And so to manage the size of the liquidations on the loan bucket would need very small issuances of callable debt to make that realistic. And again, that's investors are not going to be happy with that. So the callable debt can be used to an extent, can be a relatively good blunt hedge, but in isolation, it's not sufficient to manage the problem. Okay.
Just to go back to the penalties for a second, we don't really have to worry about that so much here, though, do we? Because we're just focusing on the fact that prepayments do happen, and so that risk has to be managed. Yeah?
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
Exactly. The penalties work in compensating part of the hedging costs and other things, but the NIM keeps varying, so that's what the focus is.
Usually there's legal restrictions on how big those amounts can be as well, because just sort of common law principles, you can't prevent people repaying their debt, right? There's usually consumer protection and things around. So, and even if you have to pay an additional amount to prepay, all of that, because penalty is a bit of an emotive word, I think. People still die, get divorced, sell houses, so that even though it might not be economically rational, it will still happen.
Yes, absolutely. So there, I'm not sure I can say that every jurisdiction. I'm not sure that every jurisdiction has mandated that you must allow prepayment in some way, shape, or form. I think there are probably some contracts which cannot be broken. So I don't know that that's this. I'm not sure I can make that statement, but.
But we don't have to think about it, really, do we? We're just dealing with assuming that it does happen.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. On slide 14, this is perhaps the most common approach to prepayment risk and how it's considered and managed. Most institutions will use kind of an expected cash flow method to do that. They will estimate how customers will behave, and then they will project those cash flows accordingly based on those expected assumptions. Each time an organization will do this, they will start off with three buckets. The first bucket will generally be called the core bucket, the first bucket. Those are customers that will liquidate their loan over the life of it for any reason, even if it's not in their best interest. So Sue's comments about someone might pass away, the estate will likely liquidate a loan, someone might move, they might change, might win the lottery, all kinds of reasons. But so the point there is that there's some amount of the loans that will liquidate before maturity regardless. The second bucket here, the last layer, the bottom layer, it's almost the inverse of that. Those are borrowers who will never prepay their loan, regardless of what incentive they have. They're going to last to maturity. They could win the lottery 10 times and they still wouldn't prepay their loan. Those customers do exist. The third bucket, which is unfortunately the biggest bucket, is the rate sensitive piece. So those are customers who will behave in a classic sense rationally. With economic incentive, they will act when they are incented to do so. So, again, I'll just repeat the point. It's very common for institutions to allocate percentages of loans or percentage of portfolios into these buckets and then estimate the prepayment behavior on that basis. So on slide 15, this matrix at the bottom here is effectively what people will do. It's overly simplified, but it's the point across is you'll take your portfolio of loans, in this case the 1,000 currency units I have, and I'll start to allocate them into the buckets and assume that their maturity will happen at that time. So here I've put the core bucket into year one, the sensitives are in two and three, and then the bottom is obviously going to be the last, considering they will last to maturity. Slide six.
Just a quick question of fact is, you know, you've given 5% core, 10% bottom, and and 85% in between, is that an act, you know, of, I'll call it a faithful representation of how things split out, or is it, it doesn't matter, I just want to, I don't have a good sense of what degree of prepayment we're talking about.
The short answer is yes, at plus or minus a couple of percentage points.
Yeah.
To say the core bucket is around 5, that's fair. The bottom layer around 10, that's probably fair as well. Again.
So the scale of prepayments really is, you know, dominates?
Yeah.
You know, according to this, it's 80-ish percent.
I would say that's fair, but okay. It's difficult to comment about everywhere.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I have a related question. Man, is this including the penalty people have to? Because man, if it is economic,
exactly,
makes sense. I think, man, at least from my home country, I think we don't have so much of 85% because that makes the rational including the penalty, and the penalty is very high. So I would assume, okay, in some jurisdictions, people who look at kind of, okay, is it economic interest, but including sensitivity, I think, is a little bit less. Right?
I think the Germans are much more rational than other people.
No, my point is, okay, man, this kind of sensitivity, kind of, but does it include in your example now the penalty or not? Because I think that is...
Perhaps the way I could answer the question is, when I say something is like this material here is really focusing on no penalties. So if you were to say, if I were to do this chart differently with a loan that has the penalty in there, then there would be a very large kick from this out of the sensitive piece because people would start to...
My point is only to avoid maybe the impression that people think, okay, 85% of all loans are prepaid. I think that is not true.
Correct.
Right?
That could be specific for a particular jurisdiction where you have the behavior and how the penalty kicks in and where, and also jurisdiction specific. I don't think we can say that works across the board, like in Germany or Europe, or where I come from, it won't. 85% of the loans won't be prepayable because most of the people will hold to majority. And also, even without the penalty, the bottom layer becomes bigger. So it depends on the jurisdiction. So this, I would say, maybe specific from where Ross has come, but it's more used as an example to see how the allocation is done. It's difficult to give average numbers across the globe for this.
Thank you. These examples are just based for mainly for their discussion of the prepayment risk. As Sue said, this is quite a simplistic model. And Mary said that maybe the prepayment pattern of this example maybe not representing the, maybe some cases of the specific banks under their interest rate decrease, like the current situation. But if the interest rate is not decreased, maybe quite stable, then prepayment risk might be very low, maybe. That's one thing. Another thing is if the interest rate changes, like, you know, from 6% to 2% or 1%, then that decrease in market interest rate might affect that asset side as well as liability side. So core deposit might be disappeared because of the, you know, the interest rate is so low, so they might go to the other financial instrument. So this market change might affect everything. However, we are just assumed away many the distortions, so just focusing on the prepayment risk on the loans.
Yes.
So what I'm saying is just the assumption of this everything on these, you know, examples, we need to say very carefully in the beginning, this is very unrealistic. We are about focusing on some specific parts on the asset side, not the liability side. This kind of explanation might be helpful for us to understand these examples.
No, that's entirely fair. The purpose, the examples are simplistic for the purposes of exposition and for the purpose of discussion. So to have a sit down and have a conversation about the entire idea of prepayment risk for the entire balance sheet, I would need 256 slides. And I've already given you 56. But it's fair.
Go on, Ross.
The only point here, just to comment as we go, I'm going to go back to the starting point of this example, is that just the setup here is so the funding in these following discussions, core deposits, they've been assessed as 0% perpetual. And so there's work that goes into that assessment that's been done. Management has decided that it's in their interest to have the repricing happen over a period of a year. So kind of the target profile in the following examples is 1 year. Keep that in mind. Slide 16 is just the representation of that matrix in the more the picture that we're used to seeing. So you can see how the loans are all have the same interest rate on them. They just have the same yield, but they're allocated to different time periods based upon their expected behavior there. I show it this way just to reinforce the comment that when I manage the profile, I'm going to do it using this asset profile when I make the comparison. So this is the picture that we'll be used to seeing. Okay. Please turn to slide 19. So core prepayment is relatively straightforward. So I have this expectation that 5% or 50 currency units are going to last a year. That's exactly the chosen profile I wanted. I said I wanted things to last for a year. So when I do my comparison here, I have 1 year assets, I have a 1 year target, I have no problem, I have no mitigating actions required. Point here is that as long as I get that assumption right, and that's my profile, then actually I don't need any mitigating actions. So this example here, there's nothing more to do. The only comment is if I get my assumption wrong, NIM will be different than I expected.
So the way that this is done, does it mean that as long as you've got, whatever it was, 5% of loans or whatever that behave in this way, that you're right? So it's not that I've sort of selected particular loans in my portfolio that I expect to behave in, you know, category A, B, and C, and if they behave differently, I've got it wrong. It's as long as, from a sort of portfolio perspective, the percentages are okay in each of these categories that I've got. Right, is that the assessment? It's
yes.
Sort of not at an asset level?
It's at a portfolio level. The portfolio is not going to be the entire, in this case, loan portfolio. You would form buckets of loans that would behave similarly. Mm-hmm. And so it would be loans in theory that originated around the same time, have got the same type of yield and probably the same type of customer behind it. You can kind of predict a certain amount of customer behavior based on some facts you can gather, but I don't want to get into too much of that. And the answer to your question is it's done at a portfolio level, but that portfolio is perhaps smaller than you might think it is, but it's still a portfolio.
Can I ask a question, Ross, about what you mean by expected on slides 15 and 16? Is that what you think will actually happen? Because these are rate-sensitive assets. Or is it what you think, given the current interest rate environment, or is it what you think, given the prices implied by current forward rates?
It's effectively what the price is implied by current forward rates. It is the expectation of what you think will happen, not what, how you, you would not make this assumption blind to what could change in the future. So implicit in the expectation would be some estimation of what you think is likely to occur.
And if your view was different from the rates implied by the forward rates, would you go with your rate or with what's implied by the market?
The institution has to decide what it thinks is going to happen. And so if the institution believes forwards, that's great. If they don't, then they don't. Okay. Slide 21 discusses, just again, illustrates the bottom layer here. People might say, okay, well, is this really any different than anything else? And the answer is not really. The profile below on the bottom here shows that if I think things will last to maturity, then the model is matured to year five. If I want a one-year profile here, I've got a misalignment of repricing. So mitigating actions are required. So mitigating actions are no different than they would be for any other assets. So on slide 22, it's the usual swap site that I've come to talk about. I'll use two swaps to transform the portfolio. Take a five-year asset down to a one-year asset, I have a five-year pay fix, receive variable swap, and then a one-year receive fix, pay variable swap. And I transform my five-year asset into a one-year asset. Group A is offsetting, Group B is offsetting, and I'm left with the profile I desire here. So there's nothing different in this example as any other transforming action that we've discussed. But again, if I get my assumption wrong, then I effectively got the profile incorrect, and therefore it will be different. I will need different hedges. How accurate are your estimates going to be in this space is going to determine stability. Slide 24. The rate-sensitive piece is the difficult piece to discuss. It's difficult piece to manage. So I'm just going to focus on this two-year tranche, just for exposition. The three-year tranche is the same. It's just focusing on one specific year. If I look at my profile again, I have two-year loans. That's my expectation. I'll manage that to a one-year as my target. The derivatives required are shown on slide 25, but again, it's no different than what we just discussed. Where this becomes complicated is slide 26. Peter's question is that I based that assumption, my expectation is based on information at T0 based upon forward rates or based upon my expectation of what might happen, and things are going to change. And I will likely get my assumption incorrect because forward rates are difficult to predict. And so at some point in the life of this loan, I will have an update to my assumption. In this example here, I've said, okay, 3 months into the cash flows, something has changed. I now expect repricing to occur sooner. So it's no longer going to happen at 2 years, it'll happen at 1 year. So my profile now becomes a bit of a mess because I've got this two-year swap in place there, which gets rid of the two-year assets. I've got the original one-year swap. And so it's no longer aligned to the profile because things have changed on me. And so the simple answer here is I've got a change in input. It's caused a change in the asset profile and mitigating actions I've required, no different than any other change in input might be. And I'm going to be a bit disingenuous here on slide 27, but just to illustrate the point. If I look at just the loan now, compare that with the profile, I have a one-year expectation on the loan, and I wanted one-year cash flows. And so actually, if I ignore the derivatives I have, I'm okay. No mitigating actions are required. And so in theory, this would have been great. I didn't need to do the hedges, but the small problem on slide 28 is that I've already done them. So unfortunately, I need to get rid of them. And I don't want to go into the complications of how you get rid of them. It's more mitigating actions and it's more swaps that can layer on. The point there is that those swaps must be offset. They must be canceled in some impact, in some way, shape, or form. Those actions will cause NIM volatility. And so the NIM profile will change, A, because I got my assumption wrong, and so the asset will be a little bit different than I was expecting. And B, that I've got, in theory, quote unquote, the wrong hedges now. And so I have to fix that. And given that most of this behavior will change due to a change in interest rates, hedges are used to cancel up. The old hedges are going to be at a different rate, and so there will be some gain or loss on the transaction. So that will impact NIM going forward. I think your understanding the concept here is that this cash flow method of managing prepayment risk is based upon make an assumption, you manage that assumption. Assumption proves to be incorrect because you get new or better information, you update your assumption, then you manage accordingly. NIM volatility will result every time you get an assumption incorrect, and you take mitigating actions to manage that. So I'll just pause there. That's effectively the conclusion of the cash flow section of the material.
Okay, very good. Mary, did you have a question?
I did, but I have a feeling it's something that Ross declared out of bounds, so I'll ask it and you can say it's out of bounds. Which is your point about closing out, is the typical behavior to enter into offsetting transactions, or is it to literally cancel entered into a swap for 2 years, what is it going to cost me to terminate now?
It's more common to offset.
It's cheaper
to offset, and there's a, can't say this for all economies, but the requirements to clear swaps, most interest rate swaps now must be centrally cleared, and the clearinghouses really do not want you to unwind the swap. So if you want to get out of a position, they say, okay, just transact an offsetting. I can't say that's going to be that way forever, and I can't say that everybody has to go through those rules, but...
No, I was asking about typical behavior rather than...
Okay. Slide 30. So, given it's difficult to get assumptions right all the time, a strategy that can be used as a derivative strategy is simply to buy an option. You can describe a prepayable loan as I've given a put option to the customer. Callable debt works because I have a put option myself. And so a way to do this is just to buy an option. Those markets exist and they can be used to manage prepayment risk. An option will generally give you the right to receive interest rates at a certain level from a specific period of time. So said differently, the option I show on page 30 here, that will allow me to receive interest rates as at T0. So T0 pricing, I can access that pricing at any point over the life of the option. That ability to access historical rates at any time, that's great, but that's expensive. That costs money. That's interest rate swaps generally are 0% for zero PV on day one. There's no cash flows that are exchanged at the offset. Therefore, there's no cost. Options are different. As I'm buying insurance effectively, I must pay the insurance premium for that. And that is an amount of money that goes out the door at the time of purchase. This example here, I've said it's $2.50. And so I can, for sake of simplicity in the example, it amortizes it over 5 years, and we'll leave that to the side. But I must pay my counterparty $2.50 at inception. That's the time value of this option, the value associated to what might happen in the future. So the example on slide 30, walk you through it quickly. I've got a loan, prepayable, the same prepayable loan for 6.5%. I've got my debt again for 5.5%. I've got this rate to receive for 5 years, which is option there, and then I've got the option premium itself, which I'm assuming is going to be amortized over 5 years. So down here I get back to a NIM of 50 basis points at the starting point. On slide 31, go to step two, rates are going to decrease, the customer is going to refinance, and I'll see my NIM will drop. You see that my original NIM, I'll take away the loan of the yield of the old loan, I'll add in the yield of the new loan, and I go from 50 basis points down to minus 150. Nothing different there, just loss on the prepayment event. Need to amortize my option cost. Step three, I exercise my option. It gives me the right to receive T0 rates. And so this example here, as the loan yield decreased by 200 basis points, the option will allow me to receive effectively a fixed cash flow of 200 basis points over the remaining tenor here. And so I'm able to cancel the NIM repricing by exercising my option, taking advantage of that. And so the option strategies are very effective because regardless of why you prepay or when you prepay, you're able to effectively cancel that the effect of that on them. So it's a pretty effective way to manage. But you might say, okay, well, are you finished at step three? And the answer is unfortunately no. Because as I pointed out, I've got a new loan, and that new loan is likely prepayable. Theoretical world. And so the option did a good job of hedging the first prepayment, but then I exercised it. So I can't re-exercise the same option. I now need to buy a second option. So I'm going to have to repay the premium for that, which might not be 250 because these things are a bit dynamic, but I have to repay the option premium. And so if I assume I'm going to amortize that again over the five-year horizon, my NIM of 50 basis points has now gone to nothing because I've had to buy two options to hedge NIM over that period. So this drives into the question of, well, why doesn't everybody do this? It seems much better than trying to project cash flows and when you know it's going to be difficult. So why doesn't everyone just buy options or use callable debt? And the answers are the same for options and callable debt because they're effectively the same strategy, just different structures. Liquidity isn't really there. People don't like to sell options because then they have to manage the prepayment problem. And long-run profitability, that I have to pay the insurance premium up front, and the way these contracts are generally structured is I would recoup that cost from the borrower over the life of the loan. So in order to recoup that cost fully, I need the loan to last to maturity. But that's the whole point, is that it might not, and so that's the problem. So the options aren't really available, and then they're expensive. So that's why you won't see this as the dominant way to manage the risk in practice.
Simply too expensive.
So it's too expensive, and it's just not there.
It's just not there, okay.
If you wanted to buy if your portfolio, I'm making things up here, was entirely prepayable loans, you couldn't buy all the options if you wanted to.
Yeah.
The market would not be made for you.
Okay, so we can forget about it.
I don't know if you can buy half the book or 70% of the book. You just can't buy all of them. But I might be making a statement here that people would challenge me. It's clearly a better hedge than expected cash flows. And so it's a dominant strategy. It's just an expensive strategy. Some people might say, well, it's expensive, and so if I'm really good at estimating cash flows, then I don't have to spend the premium. And that's the counter argument. But anyways, I think it's better. So slide 35 is just kind of my overall conclusion on prepayment risk. So certain loans enable the customers to prepay at any time without penalty. Penalties do exist in lots of jurisdictions, and they are a great tool to mitigate prepayment risk. A lot of this material we've talked about just kind of assumes there are no penalties around, just for the sake of exposition. very common to manage this on an expected cash flow basis and to mitigate actions accordingly based upon your target profile and what your expected cash flows are. If you get your assumptions wrong, you obviously need to update your mitigating actions. Option-based strategies, I think, are better than expected cash flow strategies, but they're expensive and they're probably not doable in the size to cover all of the risk that exists in the marketplace. So, any questions on prepayment risk? Slides 37 through 40 are just a summary of where we've been before. But that really is kind of the end of the education side, I think, of risk management. Everyone at the board table are now experts in dynamic risk management. I understand everything there is to know about the subject. So I would like to move to slide 41.
I'll ask a couple of questions just on the premise that the cost of deposits is zero. And really just to understand the context of that, has that always been the case, or is that really a phenomenon post the financial crisis that we've had a period of, you know, very low long-term interest rates? And equally, over the last 2 to 3 years, we've seen negative deposit rates as well, and whether there's more intra-rate sensitivity to those rates now, we've gone to actually having negative rates.
So I would say that the concept of a large amount of deposits being zero or near zero and not repricing, that a portion of that has existed for a very, very long time. So that would say before the crisis, there was a large amount of funding that would still be zero and would not reprice. I think it's fair to say that since the crisis has brought interest rates down so low that there are now more of those deposits which are at zero rates because effectively they've gone through the floor. To say that those deposits which are impacted by the crisis will forever be that way is a different statement. And so we've kind of glanced over the details of it. I always make the statement. Management has assessed that the deposits are 0% perpetual. There's a lot of effort that goes into making that assessment. And so things along the lines of what's going to happen in the future, do we think that if rates go up, will customers continue to behave the way they behave today? Is that going to maintain? What about negative interest rates? What is that going to have? Is that something I could feasibly do, is charge my customers negative rates? So those questions are asked in that assessment, and they are relevant questions, but I think the short answer to your question is yes, people consider it. And the end result that comes out when management says, I think this amount is 0% perpetual, they have asked those questions and they are willing to defend their assumptions on that basis.
Just to follow up the Dick's comments, I bring Chinese cases. Yeah, because currently the dynamic risk management is mainly, you know, there's an assumption there for cold deposits, there are no maturity, no interest bearing, and no, you know, repricing risk there. In China, the deposit rate always higher than zero. Sometimes even much higher, because the banking compete each other to try to absorb more deposits. So the rate is not zero, always not zero. So in this case, whether dynamic risk management objective or this strategy will also apply, or because it's a follow up, which kind of hedging accounting will apply. If this assumption doesn't exist, so that means all of those strategy, risk management strategy, should not apply this one, and they should not apply, you know, accounting treatment. They should have fully apply IFRS 9. Yeah. So this is the basic assumption, or the cold deposit could be more than zero.
The important part of the core deposit conversation is not the interest rate that's paid. It's that it's fixed, and that is that it will not change, and even if it does change, it'll change by a fraction of what the actual change in market interest rates has been. So if I'm going to pay someone 5 basis points, but I'm going to pay them 5 basis points forever, it's now a 5 basis point perpetual life cost of funding. So yes, the cost of it might not be zero, but the implications of the change, how that will change over time, are no different. I might not be able to just swipe it off my equation as I did earlier, but if I then focus on changes, I can swipe.
The fact that it's not so interest rate sensitive and it's a fixed amount and the fact that it's got a life in practice that's longer than what its strict contractual life might be.
Yep.
That's still relevant. Yeah.
Absolutely. Some people, when they talk about this, they'll talk about non-maturity deposit modeling, but they'll make comments of, as long as it is permanent and non-interest sensitive, that becomes the important question to ask. Not if it's zero rate or contractually zero rate, it's just not rate sensitive, as it will not reprice with changes in rates, and it'll be around for a very long time.
Can I ask another question? Because currently cases, a lot of behavior factor inside. So I'm thinking that it should be, as Peter said, that you have to predict future, expect cash flow, future behavior, all of these things should be have there. Yeah. So that means the bank should have a very soft, very advanced IT system or database behind of those dynamic risk management. So I'm not sure. In China, I think for the big banks, it's difficult to do that. I'm not sure this kind of database or fundamental, you know, the things has been in UK or other European banks. They do have this kind of fundamental, you know, support for this kind of dynamic risk management. Because, well, if we look at the loan side, liability side, actually, they always change. Yeah. So it's really dynamic, but can we manage that? Yeah, it's the basic assumption there. Then we can go to the accounting instrument. If they always change it, you know, and my worry is that if the liability and the asset could be matched, or the derivative bond, or even those derivative option or swap, they can match each other. 100%, it's no problem. But they all based on expectation future. If I buy option or swap much more than expected, or much more than actually we needed, and those option and the swap could not be sell or liquid, you know, at one day or several months, very quickly. So at first we try to manage the risk, to reduce risk, and finally many swaps and options come out, and they could not be matched to the assets or liability exactly 100%. So more and more risk will come out based on current model. So the example is a very idea, but in practice I'm not sure whether they can match it from based on the term, based on amount, based on the behavior. Is it whether we can done in practice?
Well, Ross thinks it can, right?
I can speak from my experience that it can be done, and it can be done to a very high level of accuracy. And it does require systems. It does require investment. It requires teams, and it requires stress testing, understanding how things will behave in different circumstances. And so, yes, it's complicated, but complicated doesn't mean it's not possible. It just means it's hard.
But I think Chitinshaw was making a broader point, if I understood correctly, which was that assumes you actually have the sort of data and statistics, etc., to back up the expectations so that they are solid expectations. And I think that was at the heart of your question, if I understood it, Chitinshaw. Yeah. We're sort of working on the assumption that that's the case, but at the core, the first question is, how solid are those expectations, and what's the basis for those, right?
But I suppose that if in the situation in China is that you have de facto a variable deposit rate, then you can manage your interest margin through that rate, and
Great.
You don't need all this.
Correct.
Much simpler.
But the other thing also, I understand, and you made also another point, which is that if we keep adding derivatives to it, at what point are we managing risk? And we have moved on that to taking on risk. Hmm. Absolutely agree. The matching is important, and any model we consider has to consider that point, because very easily when we look at it, you keep layering things in, and if you have lost control, you're no longer managing the asset profile, but you're creating a different kind of a risk profile. So that is a different area which we will have to look at. Absolutely. The other point where whether these assumptions, and I agree, it is data intensive. It is required. But let's not forget, we are looking at this in the context of interest rate risk. Banks look at it, this profile, much more critically in the context of liquidity. Because if you don't get your this liquidity assessments right and you have gaps, then you can actually have a run on the bank. And that's what is done much more also just as carefully and if not more critically, because that's what people don't want to have, especially any kind of regulation system. So yes, there are assumptions, there is data involvement and everything, but I would say depending upon what is your level of sophistication, this analysis is done, I would say, in most jurisdictions to see how long your deposits will be there, because otherwise there's a bank run.
Martin.
I might agree what Kumar has said, because based on my understanding, if you don't have as a bank a proper interest rate risk management, liquidity management, the regulators will close the bank. So I think in every bank there is this kind of interest rate risk management. I think there are different levels of how people are doing that, sophistication. But I think all of that needs, okay, assumptions and estimate of future cash flows. Because that is the purpose of risk management. You have uncertain cash flows and you want to manage it. And if you have certainty, you don't need risk management. So uncertainty is a kind of part of risk management. And clearly, things can go wrong, and other end you have to assume, but then you have to take actions, I think, to make, and as Ross said, you have to do it maybe daily or weekly or monthly to correct that. But the core principle is, I think, that is the core risk of a bank, and I think any regulators will require you to have a proper interest rate risk management. And it has to deal with this kind of uncertainty.
Just piling on a little bit, so I'd agree with the points about, I think this works very well in sophisticated environments, works very well with illiquid markets and availability. You do find, and it's a closely regulated part of banking activities because of the liquidity risk, because of pricing risk and other things. What you do tend to find is if banks are operating in emerging economies, for example, and you're operating without those that starting point, so data availability and or liquid markets, what that tends to do is affect your product design. So you're inclined to rely less on your core deposits or your demand deposits. You're inclined to price more at variable rates instead of fixed rates. You're inclined not to allow prepayments if that's going to have an effect. So you will find within the same bank, if you've got investments in different jurisdictions, slightly different strategies in each jurisdiction to reflect the lack of that information if it's available. And as I agree with everybody, it tends to be very, very closely regulated. It's something the regulators look at quite hard because of exactly the issues you spoke about.
I didn't want to get into it. The other point which comes up is that if you are in one of those jurisdictions and other things, let's say your model says X percent, you will get a significant haircut to determine what is the core balance coming out because of the uncertainty and other things in the model. So the modeling for the core element in quite a few of the jurisdictions is not trying to target the accurate profile, but trying to make sure that you never breach that, because if not for interest rate, you have problems with liquidity if that happens.
Thank you. Maybe this is not a good time to discuss on this question, Mike. Okay, Jim Chow raised an interesting point. So I'm just curious about our description of the meaning of fixed rate.
Okay.
It might decide the scope of this standard, if we can make, because you are saying core deposit, if the one constraint we are going to put on is just a fixed rate. So what does it mean, this fixed? Do you have any explanation?
To call something non-rate sensitive, maybe to answer the question a bit differently, that would be determined as if you have a large change or a reasonable size change in market interest rates, so they go from 1 to 5. Do your depositors force you to give them more money? And if the answer to that question is mostly no, then they're not rate sensitive. If they start to demand more compensation to keep the money at the bank, then they are rate sensitive. So that's effectively how that conversation would be had, is when you have a change in rates, what do you have to do to keep the customers at the bank?
What I'm saying is that kind of a setting policy industries might be different from countries, maybe different from the banks' So it might not easy to describe our scope of this one. We are assuming the fixed rate, but the fixed rate is, we need some clarification.
Do not disagree, Jungle. It will be fun trying to scope this, yes.
I'm out of.
Excellent. Just to put some numbers first, I'd like to really acknowledge the staff for this education session. I think you captured very well and simplified very well the prepayment risk. It's one of the key risks in the banking system. And just to put some numbers in the question posed by Qingtao, and I agree with Martin and Daryl in terms of risk management. This is a very core concern with bank regulators, the interest rate risk and the liquidity risk and all the potential effects this can have in the whole system solvency and stability. And one way to do that is in many markets is having a significant portion of products in variable rates, so it makes life much, much easier. This is the very case of Brazil. And to illustrate the number, why is that important? 1 year ago, the interest rates, basic interest rates in Brazil was 14.25%. This month is 8.25%. So imagine a bank dealing with prepayment risk associated with the right. And Sue mentioned, although briefly, the consumer rights. In most countries, the consumer rights in the financial sector is getting more and more attention, and generally the consumer has the right to prepay any loan they have. So this is very much a point of concern. I think we are trying to capture here a real life daily management in most banks. Of course, the more sophisticated the bank, the more detailed the system will be. One thing that we didn't mention, but it's fine because this is not seeking to mention every single aspect that would influence the prepayment risk, but there are two aspects at least that in my former life we identified. One is psychological, simply. People don't like change. So many people simply don't bother to go to their bank because the interest rate is down for 0.5% or 1%, and started the whole process of prepayment, going to another bank, the process of looking for alternatives. So this is very much real life. And the second is the lack of financial literacy in most countries. So people simply don't know that they have the right, or people simply don't know how to calculate the benefit or to assess the benefits and risks associated with prepayment. So this is also important. So why I mentioned that, it's the core, yes, deposit, it's a reality, even when they have the prepayment right in jurisdictions. And there are, as Daryl mentioned, there are emerging markets that lack data, but there are other emerging markets that do have significant amount of data that allows banks to perform the risk management in a very high level. Sue was with me a couple of years ago when we visited Brazil, and the sophisticated banks in Brazil, they have a significant amount of data, and they are able to perform this relatively well. So this is very much something that we can see almost, I would say, everywhere in the world, at least for Tier 1 sophisticated banks.
Okay.
On slide 41, just almost switching concepts here, and I will utter the first phrase of hedge accounting in all the education sessions. So we've been through almost 100 pages of material, and I have not used the word accounting yet. So. I'm going to start by talking about capacity. I want to compare risk management activities across different sectors very briefly, draw some conclusions there. That will lead into introducing the concept of capacity, and then we'll have a quick commentary, perhaps a quick discussion on how capacity will influence content of financial statements. So on slide 42 and 43, margin is just the net of cash inflows to an institution versus its cash outflows. That's the same for banking. That's the same if you're a coffee producer. That's the same if you make paper. It's just the net of revenue, cost of goods sold. That's what margin is. In lots of industries, margin can be heavily influenced by market factors beyond the control of management. If the cost of raw materials can change, market price of whatever you're going to sell can change. If those factors can change on management and they can negatively influence profitability or performance, and management has the ability to do something about it, it might be in their best intentions to do so. I think the example here, if a toothpaste company had the ability to have toothpaste pricing forwards, then they might use them to manage their cash inflows over the long run. These forwards, as far as I know, don't exist. But it's a bit of a silly example, but still, that's the point there. If the products exist, you face the risk, it might be in management's best interest to do something about it. And that's going to be the case for banking and any other sector that's there. I can, on slide 44, I kind of walk through this example of coffee producers. So if I'm manufacturing coffee, I have input price risk from price of raw beans, and I have sale price risk on whatever the market price of coffee is at a given point in time. So over the life of the cycle here, from now to when I buy the beans to when I refine them and turn them into coffee and then sell them, I bear the price risk of everything there over that time series. Cost of inputs goes down, that's great. If the price of outputs goes up, that's great. But those can go the other way. And so a coffee producer, much like a bank, is forced to make a decision as to, does it want to bear the risk of price volatility in its products, or does it want to do something about it? I pick on coffee because coffee does have liquid markets for derivatives. It's just an example. So there are industries that are faced with the exact same problem of, how do I want to manage this risk, and for what period of time do I want to manage it? Let's pause there.
Ross, looking at slide 44, I just wanted to check a reaction I had in your focus on when the coffee is sold. And my reaction is that there's different level of activity and management you can undertake when there's kind of real-time pricing versus delays or lags in pricing. And what I'm thinking about is, if you are buying beans, roasting them, and then selling them into a retail market,
yes,
you probably can't change your retail prices every day. So I don't think when it's sold, I think it's when it's priced.
That's fair.
And I'm bringing that up. I'm sorry, it's a bit of a picky point, because I think when you're trying to make us think about what are the activities, it depends, where the risk is depends on how much you can push things through the whole distribution channel. And so presumably in a retail distributor, it's pricing. If you're selling, let's say, only into wholesale markets, it might end up when you enter into contracts, or you might set pricing for a period of time. Is that right?
That's fair. Okay. I think I'm saying sale, which is, you're quite right. I probably should say time of pricing of sale.
Yeah.
I think that's fair.
And I'm assuming that the risk management activity focuses on, let's say,
it would focus when the cash inflow, when that amount is determined, and that would be at pricing probably. Slide 45. It's a simple concept. So I can make the point here. I can forwards exist. They can be executed. I can strike them to fix in cash inflows. I can strike them to fix in cash outflows. And so I can fix margin at T0 here if I really wanted to. Something that's perfectly doable. Slide 46 is a bit more of a conversation about hedge accounting, and that if I weren't going to hedge account for these forwards, they're likely going to be called derivatives, and so they will be fair value through the profit, through the statement of profit and loss. If I hold them to maturity, then I'll have these unrealized gains that will kind of move around with market prices. But if at the end of the life cycle of the transaction, so I've finally priced and sold, on a cumulative basis, the net cash inflows will be equal to what the forward contracts say. And so you get potentially this volatility if I don't use hedge accounting. That's just the measurement mismatch that we're all familiar with. In this example here, I likely have two qualifying relationships. I likely have two highly probable forecast transactions, and so I'm able to designate the hedges against the cash inflows and the cash outflows, so I'll get a highly effective result. I would have, obviously, it's cash flow accounting in this example, so I'm fixing cash flows on transactions, so I would record the changes in OCI. But the point here is that I've been able to address the measurement mismatch. I'm able to reflect my risk management actions in the income statement without introducing the volatility that can confuse. So this company is able to designate their purchase leg, and they're able to designate their sale leg. Two legs here are their margin equation, and they're able to designate both. So they're not necessarily constrained by anything. Any questions there? No questions. 48 switches back to banking. And that's, I'm going to start with an example of banking where I'm 100% debt funded. So this is, not realistic, but for the purpose of exposition. And so here I have 5-year fixed loans and external debt for 3 years. For 3 years' time. This organization is not comfortable that the.
Prior to the financial crisis, it was 98%. It's not so. It's not completely imaginative.
Go on.
Move on.
Fill up my water just to. So this company is not comfortable with the repricing mismatch of assets. They would like them to be aligned in an assumed stabilization strategy. And so they need mitigating actions to align repricing. Slide 49 walks through those actions. Again, repetitive here. So I 5-year cash flows on a loan. I need to have a 5-year pay fixed swap. 3-year cash flows on the debt. I need a 3-year pay fixed swap. The end result of that is that I've reduced NIM from 1% to 50 basis points, but I've now aligned repricing going forward. So potential volatility on the long run is reduced for this organization. So that's the risk management objective. In slide 50, this organization is able to designate. They have to use fair value hedge accounting, so it's a different type of hedge accounting, but I can designate the cash inflows, the loan, in a fair value hedge, and I can designate the cash outflows, the debt, in a fair value hedge. Given there's alignment between the hedges, the length of the hedges and the length of the loans, and the length of the hedges and the length of the debt, everything will be highly effective. For value hedge accounting, so I won't record an OCI, I'll put it through the income statement, but I'll have some adjustments on the carrying values. But again, an effective designation is possible. The purchase leg, the debt, and the sale leg, the loan, are eligible hedged items, and I can have a perfectly effective hedge. So this organization, Bank A, is able to reflect the risk management in the financial statements. And you can see where I'm building to.
Mm-hmm.
So Bank B, they are 100% core deposit funded. Again, not realistic, because of exposition. The deposits are assessed as 0% perpetual, and they've got a 5-year fixed rate loan. This company is not comfortable with 5-year repricing for whatever reason. They decide they would like it to be 7-year repricing. Maybe they want stability for a longer period of time for any number of reasons. And so they can execute the derivatives that are required on page 52. 5-year pay fixed swap, 7-year receive fixed swap. Match them up again. NIM in this case is an unrealistic level of 8.5, but that's fine given current rates. It's fixed for that 7 years time, and there's no cash uncertainty that will come to this organization. On slide 53, I now start to highlight a problem note. The coffee producer and Bank A were able to designate, able to reflect their risk management because they could designate the purchase and sale leg of their margin equation without real constraint. In a one-to-one hedge accounting model, this bank has got a problem. There's no issue with the pay fixed swap. The pay fixed swap will match the loan, and that's an eligible hedged item, so I can hedge account for half of my necessary derivatives. But the receive fixed swap is a bit more challenging. In a one-to-one place, the only thing that else that exists on this balance sheet is a deposit. And the deposits don't have cash flow risk. We've said they're perpetual fixed rate. They don't have to be zero, but they're fixed rate, so they don't have cash flow variability, so I can't do a cash flow hedge. And does it really have reliable fair value risk? Individual depositor, what exactly is the fair value of that going to be? That's not something that can be easily determined, and such not reliable, so I'm not sure that's really going to qualify for a relationship. And so given those facts and the comments we've said, is the deposit really being hedged here? Or is it really back to NIM and how NIM is going to reprice? That's really the hedged item, how that's going to change in market factors here. So in a traditional hedge accounting model, one-to-one designations, Bank B cannot designate half of their required derivatives. And so they're left with a problem as to what do they do with that. Now, you might comment that I've made this example unrealistic. It's 100% debt funded, and they want to change all of their loans. I'll take that as an example. But the business model of fixed rate loans and significant amounts of core deposit funding, that's very common in lots of jurisdictions where they have fixed rate loan products and significant amounts of deposit funding. Not every jurisdiction, that's quite fair. But lots of jurisdictions, that's a common business model. And so on slide 54, I start to make a conclusion, offer a conclusion, that Bank B is always going to struggle, as they require twice as many derivatives as they have eligible cash inflows to designate against. That is as a result of the uniqueness of core deposits. There aren't many industries out there that just get free funding or low-cost funding for a very long period of time. Not many industries, their purchase leg of the margin equation is this kind of unique aspect of it. So in practice, these deposits comprise large portions of funding for especially the banking book of banks. If you look at a balance sheet of an institution, the liability side has lots of businesses in it. Look at the banking book, the amortized cost world. Deposits are a large percentage of that funding. And so they're faced with this capacity problem, capacity being what's eligible, in that in theory I've got 100% of my loans, my sale legs that are eligible, and then 50% of my purchase leg, assuming I've got 50% debt funded. And so how am I supposed to fit, in a simple example, 200 units of derivatives to hedge 100 units of risk as to what's eligible? So that creates this capacity problem as to what am I going to do with that? And how you solve that capacity problem, have the options on page 55. And so they have the ability to proxy hedge, they have the ability to not hedge or to change their risk management approach, or they're kind of forced into alternative performance metrics. So those are perhaps overly simplifying their options, but that's pretty good coverage of what they can do.
Just to clarify one point regarding the core demand deposits, absolutely the hedge designation restriction comes because of that, but also very clearly the requirement in 13 that you can't have a demand deposit measured at anything other than par, make it very clear. It's the fair value of a demand deposit is the amount payable on demand discounted from the earliest date. Not the exact words, but that's also a requirement, and it's there for the reasons Ross mentioned. So it's a very clear requirement in 13.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your explanation. It was excellent. And the capacity issue, I think, is the heart of this project. This is the most difficult area which we need to challenge. And hearing your explanation, I felt the impression that the kind of managing NIM is like a telling a lie.
It's like telling a lie.
I mean, I didn't choose the word, but when you tell a lie first, then you know, in order to cover up that lie, you have to tell another lie. And you have to be careful to be consistent with the first lie and second lie, and then you have to tell the third lie. And then you have to manage the portfolio of lies, and you have to manage the capacity of lies.
That's
very
from
difficult.
My past experience.
Difficult management. And the reason why I got that impression is because you compared the coffee beans example and the bank B example, and that has a clear difference. In the case of coffee beans example, that their business is to process the coffee from bear coffee to the refined coffee. So their margins, origin, source of margin is the produce, process the coffee. So then the price of coffee is a kind of noise. So in order to get rid of the noise, they go into the hedging activity. So to get rid of the noise, then they can clarify their real margin is all about. Maybe in the case of Bank A, it's a little bit similar. But in the case of Bank B, they already have zero rate deposit. So then their margin, total NIM is, as you described, it's a loan yield. But they want to make up it as if it's a stable margin like a coffee bean makers. So in a sense, the real question is why do they want make it stable? I mean, the real fundamental question should go to slide 8, which is the case study 1, prepayment. This isn't just a prepayment risk, but you said that unexpectedly 2% change of NIM. But what is wrong with it? That is the question we need to consider, because they already have 4.5% profit, and they are having no interest rate deposit, and they can earn money as long as the cost is zero. So what is wrong with, you know, 2% change? That is the fundamental question. Why do they avoid 2% change? And that if we know, why do they need to avoid 2% change? So we would come to the, you know, the aim of this project.
Without going into that, I don't want to go to by saying I want to come up with another portfolio. One of the things to look at it, even if it's 0%, one, your interest rates fall. You can stop earning your basic overhead costs if interest rates drop like the way Amaro gets, and you will go bankrupt. I think that is a fair management objective. You can. The other thing is also, let's not forget that what you are doing is that everybody in the market has also got a 0% base and they are lending in the market. You also have to remain competitive, and that's why people manage the thing. I don't think there's any difference if you have got inputs and you have foreign currency exposure. If foreign currency rates go against you, you can take a hit in profits, but you may not have enough cash to run your company. So that's another reason why even coffee producers are more commonly, I've seen it in foreign currency, people will hedge. So the effect, just because it's 0%, I don't think it changes that. The reason why they want, what we maybe use the wrong word, or stable or anything, is because they would like to have as much of the cash flows not being subject to market variability, which they cannot control.
Yeah, I understand that point. But the point is, in the case of coffee beans, the market price change is not the source of their margins. But in the case of Bank B, the interest rate difference itself is the source of the margin. And then they want to, you know, make a kind of a hypothetical stable interest rate NIM, and then try to, you know, in a sense, to make up that stable interest rate difference. That's why in the case of Bank B has a capacity issue, they need to have to do the kind of surrogate hedging or, you know, proxy hedging. So that's why the hedge account doesn't work.
If they had left their position open, so they really had that 2% exposure in the slide 8, and we were trying to create accounting that showed that that wasn't the case, then I would agree with you, we'd be talking about lies layered on lies. But if, in effect, their risk management has put in place derivatives, that means they have locked in their net interest margin, we're trying to find a way to facilitate them showing the truth, as opposed to that being masked by having measurement mismatches. So their business model is actually to take away that risk. So they've made a choice from a business perspective that even though they've got 0% long-term funding, they don't want to be exposed in a way they would be if their loans were just doing something different. They've actually chosen to take actions to prevent that being the case. And all that Ross and Kumar is trying to help us do is to find a way to reflect the truth of their business
model. And to get rid of the accounting mismatch. Daryl.
I'm not sure I'm saying too much more than what Kumar and Sue just said. I think there's a reason why this is a closely regulated first, is because banking entities see this, as Kumar said, you can't focus on 6.5%. That's just the first two lines of the income statement. That's like your gross profit. That 6.5% then has to pay for a whole bunch of other things. And the 2% change might mean there's not enough available to pay for the other things. But I think maybe the more important point that I perhaps wanted to, and I said, I don't think it's different to what people said before, but hedging changes economics. It physically changes the nature of the business. Now, when you started talking about the portfolio of lies, where I assumed you were going, some are saying the company shouldn't hedge.
Yeah.
And they believe companies shouldn't hedge because they believe you are buying the coffee risk. But that's a different argument. Once you've done the hedging, you have changed the economics. And the accounting is now trying to say, how do I account for that changed economics?
Thank you. By the way, Ross's, all your other presentations, very well done. But I need to hear a little more about proxy hedging vis-a-vis Bank B. Now, whether if you're going to do it in the next month of the board, I'm happy to wait. Or if it's a very long answer, we can take it offline. But, I mean, you say proxy hedging, you can always buy a derivative. You might not be able to get hedge accounting. Is that the essence of what you're saying about proxy hedging? I mean, you can always buy the derivative. You can get your economic hedge.
Absolutely.
So we're just talking about accounting mismatch, or do you have something bigger in mind here?
I think when we talk about, generally, proxy hedging is a colloquial term, Gary, but I think you've coined it, is that basically because of the capacity, you will do the economic hedge and you have the derivative. And then how do you do it in a, put it in a matching hedge accounting relationship when you don't have the asset or the liability to designate it to?
When you say capacity, you mean so you don't have an item to designate.
Perhaps of a little bright line because you you designate something that you're not truly hedging.
One of the things Hans, we shouldn't be doing is literally talking about how to do proxy hedging. But one of the consequences of this is proxy hedging. We can, that's where the capacity issue comes in.
Meaning capacity to have enough hedged items that should be hedged or designated to be hedged. Okay, thank you.
So you designate a proxy.
Yeah.
Well, you find
it's something that's permitted within the boundaries of the risk management, and you look at it and see if that works.
Find overlap. Yeah.
Nick.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up about the concept of stability, and I think Tax started off making this point. Is it right to say it's not stability in absolute terms? That's not the objective. It's stability against the desired profile. Yes. And actually, management's decision over what that desired profile may change over time. They may feel that the market's consolidating, there's an opportunity for NIMs to move up through consolidation, less competition. And it's really profiling against that desired outcome rather than actually just keeping things flat over time.
Absolutely, Nick. And also the thing is, and we'll start going into when we look at the solutions in building realistic cases. Mm-hmm. Here we have said this is the absolute profile, everything is fixed and everything. In reality, it won't be. Buckets, portions will be closed, portions will be open, and that will keep changing. So that is a consequence. What happens when the profile changes as to what happens when your prepayment expectations change. So these are two different things. Absolutely.
Mary?
One of the reflections that I had looking at the Bank A, Bank B example on slides 50, 51, et cetera, I think it was Bank A had a target profile of 5 years and Bank B of 7 years.
Yes.
And it emphasizes to me that, first of all, there's no right or wrong. It's, you know, it's a strategic decision of management whether they're, you know, what their profile is. And that was probably an issue in terms of users of financial statements is understanding A, what the profile actually is that the institution has selected, and then B, how good it is at managing to achieve that profile. And so those are probably two of the things that we want to focus on in terms of improving the accounting.
Absolutely, absolutely. How do you also communicate that?
Yeah, because it's, you know, when you first come in and you get swamped by the mechanics, you're like, well, is Bank A right or Bank B right? Because there's a 5 or 7. And you're actually not going to know that in the accounting. That's a long-term, how good are they at strategically making that strategic decision. And I think we aren't trying to assess that. We're trying to get information out to allow users to assess that.
Okay. Thank you. Just a clarification. Question on that coffee shop. So basically, the analysis is very, you know, education was very nice, so it's easy to understand the issue business. But just I'm wondering, you know, if we assume a kind of a open portfolio of this coffee input purchase and output price, then we will face some issues of the dynamic hedging accounting.
Sorry, Jim, we don't understand. If we consider this as an open portfolio,
yeah, open many contracts of input purchase and output sales on these coffee production companies, then there arises some kind of a hedge accounting issue, right?
With the you mean the challenges with current hedge accounting because it's dynamic,
right?
Yes, if it's very high volume, the same issues come up, but not just anecdotal. Also, when we did the DP and we asked for the others. Most of the people told us that, remember, in coffee and other things, we use that as an example. It's never anywhere near the volumes that you get in a bank. Never anywhere near that. And I'm talking about commodity companies, not coffee, but let's say aluminium, copper, oil as well. So, yes, it does create a challenge, but what we also heard and what we have heard consistently also is that, yes, they can manage with what they have under 9, because the 9 does improve significantly on when you look at commodities and how you do the hedging and everything. But yes, if it's a very high volume, that issue does come.
Ross, I think page 55 shows pretty well why probably the need for us to do something, because either companies have to resort to sort of an artificial way of hedging, proxy hedging, or they have to use APMs, which is also something that, you know, is not always avoidable, but is not first choice. Or they may, just for accounting reasons, not hedge at all. So I think that's important for us to understand. Secondly, how do analysts manage to consume this information? Because it must be there must be a big lack of comparability. And it must be extremely hard for analysts to look through the numbers and to look through the volatility of hedging that is taking place and it's not, or the derivatives that are being used and that are not being sufficiently or artificially hedged. Must be incredibly challenging for the analyst community.
We've already taken some steps on that though, right? So when we did IFRS 9, we made some modifications to IFRS 7 to increase the amount of information provided about dynamic risk management activities in particular, to try and shed more light on what the activities are, even though we're still going to do more work on the accounting.
Yes, I won't add too much. I think it is difficult, and I think the board has taken steps to try and make that, to facilitate that conversation better. But it is a difficult conversation to facilitate.
And look back, Hans, that's one of the key drivers of this project, what you also said, is how do we communicate this dynamic, the risk management activity, given that it impacts such a large part of the banking book?
Okay, well, thank you very much. I add to all of those, Ross, who said the presentation was really excellent. We'll look forward to the next month. And we are now taking an hour for a lunch break, and we'll be back at 1 o'clock.